I've often heard the expression, beloved community. I just love the very sound of the name, beloved community. That's the place for me, I think to myself. So a while ago I set off on a bit of a ramble, maybe a wild goose chase, trying to think about community in general, the idea of a beloved community, and inevitably about my church community. I wasn't very far along in what I considered a leisurely stroll, and when John said he needed a sermon for September 17th. I've been playing with this for a while, but the sermon is far from gelling. Oh well, here's a few highlights of my little journey. There's probably a sermon in here somewhere. As I think about the subject of beloved community, I'm very aware of a prejudice I have against certain kinds of communal arrangements. Based on what connections I've had over the years with hippie communes, ashrams, skeets, and followers of various gurus, I'm suspicious of any kind of commune or intentional community. Would-be writers who gather on a farm without a thought of who would do the farming, seekers who are tired of seeking and just want someone with a knack for mystical things to do the hard work. People who want to be close to God without a bunch of riffraff created in His image to distract them. So I hereby acknowledge this prejudice. Like many people, I associate the expression beloved community with Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King was a trained theologian, so I was not surprised to find that the expression goes back to an earlier American theologian, Josiah Royce. From the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, I learned Josiah Royce, 1855-1916, was the leading American proponent of absolute idealism, the metaphysical view that all aspects of reality are ultimately unified in the thought of a single all-encompassing consciousness. And from a sample of Royce's writing, I learned that the process of getting beyond realism therefore involves a hostile and paradoxical dialectic, whereby one exposes the realistic paradoxes. The realist himself takes as little part in this process as possible and opposes to his critics merely the authority of sane common sense. Hence, to be realistic is essentially to ignore every fundamental criticism of the ontological predicate. Well, I certainly couldn't have said that better myself. Moving on as quickly as possible, I put the expression beloved community into a search engine and found James Twyman at, of all places, belovedcommunity.org. My search could have ended there had I chosen to invest in the many products that Mr. Twyman has for sale. A year-long course in soul manifestation, for example, or for $695, I could attend a Seminary of Spiritual Peacemaking, a first step on the road to becoming a minister of peace and earning a certificate in spiritual peacemaking from the Beloved Community Seminary. As I've suggested, I know myself well enough to know I'm a poor candidate for this type of thing, though I've known people who feel their lives have been improved greatly with the help of a spiritual guru like Mr. Twyman. As I had expected, most of the top hits for beloved community led me to Dr. King, and most notably to the King Center. I have to confess that I was a little put off by the King Center. When Lincoln died, he was said to belong to the ages. Evidently, Dr. King belongs very exclusively to Intellectual Properties Management, IPM, the exclusive licensor of the estate of Martin Luther King, Jr., Inc. The King Center webpage includes the following. Copyright notices. The works of authorship contained in the website, including but not limited to all design, text, sound, recordings, and images, are owned or licensed to, except as otherwise expressly stated by the Martin Luther King, Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change. We, us, are, or the King Center. Otherwise used in whole or in part in any manner without our prior written consent, except to the extent permitted by the Copyright Act 1917. This whole legal spiel worried me at first. Our denomination's motto is that they may all be one, a saying attributed to Jesus, so maybe we have to pay Jesus a state to use his words. But then I thought, wait, we are Jesus' legitimate heirs, the inheritors of his estate. Well, so I find I'm not smart enough to understand Josiah Royce. I'm put off by the commercialism of a spiritual life coach, and I dare not quote the words of Dr. King, the 20th century saint who breathed life into the expression beloved community. I wasn't off to a great start. Time to think about Fred Rogers. As is often the case for me, Mr. Rogers cuts through a lot of confusion in a way that helps me stay grounded. Consider the neighborhood of make-believe. Watch a lot of Mr. Rogers, oh, especially the operas, and take it seriously, and the neighborhood of make-believe becomes a template for a child to begin to understand what a beloved community might be. A place where strong personalities can find ways to live together and care for each other, where habits of listening and learning promote an underlying attitude of compassion, where children and adults come to understand that no matter what forces are working to destroy community, these forces haven't a chance in a world that engenders compassion, seeks peace and reconciliation, and honors every individual's quest for self-understanding and self-realization. Oh dear, as I read back over this paragraph, I think I'm sounding like Mr. Twyman, the spiritual guru I was so hard on a moment ago. Well, much to my delight, as I poked around, I found examples of existing communities that somehow decided on a community-wide basis to try a new way of being. My new favorite webpage is AEON.com, where I found an essay about Giel, a town in Belgium that has welcomed the mentally ill into the mainstream of town life for over 700 years. I quote from the essay, "A small town in Belgium you've probably never heard of could hold the solution to America's problem with mass public shootings. Shootings in malls, cinemas, and most horribly and regularly, in schools. Mentally ill men, and it is almost always men, regularly murdering as many strangers as possible. This has become one of the realities of living in America today." But it doesn't have to be like that. A small town in Belgium has quietly welcomed those affected by mental illness into their community, peacefully and happily, for 700 years. Giel's tradition takes a strictly non-medical approach to care. The town employs that old trick of basic human kindness to integrate the mentally ill into an otherwise conventional community. I know some first-class firearms are made in Belgium. I once briefly owned a Belgian Browning shotgun. I don't know if in this small Belgian town firearms are easily available to the mentally ill. I suspect not. Many of us know of L'Arche, a community in Canada that intentionally works to integrate citizens with intellectual disabilities into the mainstream of community life and has sparked the creation of similar communities worldwide. I've often said that we either have to train police in social work or else train social workers in law enforcement. I thought of this when I stumbled across a song by a group called Blue Rodeo, a song based on a true story. Could we somehow encourage this kind of community? Here's some of the lyrics to 1,000 Arms. Janie only cries when she drinks, and that's when she wakes up all the neighborhood, leaves a trail of tears around her feet. Janie says that she never knows, but she's afraid of how it just comes and goes, afraid she'll lose her way on her own street. But all the cops, they know about her. She's got so many friends around her that when she feels she's sinking down, there's a thousand arms to bring her back around. Janie says she never sleeps. She wears a red fur hat in the summer heat, leans her painted bike against your door. I know it's hard to see life so many ways. You get caught up in the thick of it. You don't know what you think of it. One thing she told me is, when you feel you're so confused, just wait until the moment passes. Wait until the moment fades away. Janie only cries when she drinks. That's when she wakes up all the neighborhood, leaves a trail of tears around her feet. But all the cops, they know about her. She's got so many friends around her that when she feels she's sinking down, there's a thousand arms to bring her back around. It does indeed take a village, ironically, a village with lots of arms. Regardless of what draws people together in community, there's almost always an urge to build a wall of some sort, a wall with a narrow gate. like an overprotective parent, we want to have some sort of wall around our cherished community to protect it from danger and to avoid troubling ideas that might cause discontent. We see this most often in domestic housing in so-called gated communities. A big stone wall keeps the wrong people out, and a gate allows the right people access to the safety and often bland sameness of the area behind the walls. What kinds of gates might we be thinking about? Many of the secret societies, fraternities, sororities, etc., have a strict requirement to gain entry through the gate. Some gates open only upon completion of some task, often an unpleasant or humiliating task that shows a willingness to abase yourself as an individual at the whim of the powerful group. Think of the silliness of swallowing a goldfish, say. And don't think of how often the silliness ends in death or injury. One reward of passing this sort of test, if you discount the harm to the individual's character and self-respect, is the future fun of treating people like you used to be, but with similar contempt. Can a beloved community be gated? As a church community, we understand that gates are common in churches, and the most common one is the gate of doctrine. The Southern Baptist Convention, fearing modernity, purged their seminaries of creeping modernity and insisted on the inerrancy of the Scripture requiring women to submit to men. Jimmy Carter, a long-standing member of this denomination, felt he had been shown the door or gate and left the denomination as a matter of conscience. Apparently, the Southern Baptist Convention agrees with Archie Bunker. He pointed out that woman was made from a rib. Who are any cheaper cuts? Some gates keep the wrong people out. Are we in trouble as soon as we realize we want to exclude some people? Are they not worthy of fellowship with us? Or do we think maybe that once we have it all figured out, then we can risk entry of the other people? Or maybe we think people prefer to be with their own kind. We could let others in, but they wouldn't be happy, so why bother? Some gates keep the right people in, sometimes for their own good, but nearly always because elements in the group enjoy power over individuals, or the group needs their resources. Cults often operate this way. Scientology would be an example if the stories of some ex-Scientologists are true. We've all seen turnstiles designed to keep people from leaving once they are in. Think Roach Motel. You can check in, but you can't check out. Sometimes the gate seems to be open, but you're kept in because the group has conditioned you to doubt your ability to survive outside. I suspect that Orthodox Jews and the Amish might well fear trying to fit in on the outside after years of living amongst a peculiar people. I'm running out of steam here. I'm beginning to realize why I called this a wild goose chase. What I'm coming around to is my usual song of praise for us. As I think back on every time I've stood up here and talked, I always end up just praising us. So the truth is out, and I'll just do that now. I always loved the joke about the guy who kept going back to the used car dealer, asking to be reminded why the car he bought was such a good deal. Now, I'm here to tell you that our little buggy is a beauty, in spite of the dings and scratches and that funny shimmy you get at about 60 miles an hour. I often listen to the recordings of Bill's sermons the last year he was our pastor. He took great pains to remind us of who we are. I also have some recordings of some testimonies of individual members, usually done as part of a pledge drive. These all remind me why I love our little jalopy, dings and all. One of the things I most love about our community is the lack of any gates, any restriction to fellowship here. Here's where I thought the quote from Groucho was relevant. Are there requirements to gain entry here? Is there a requirement of doctrine, as in so many churches? Definitely not. But if some forms of doctrine are meaningful to you on your faith journey or are cherished because of associations with the past, by all means embrace them personally and feel free to suggest that they be incorporated in some of our services. The key here is understanding what Bill Hirschfeld oft repeated, doctrine divides, compassion unites. Doctrine divides, compassion unites. Bill says he freely recites the Apostles' Creed, but a close observer will notice times when his lips don't move. Belonging to a faith community such as ours can be a juggling act, but a person learns to keep many balls in the air with no difficulty, and also feels free to put asterisks on some of the balls. We can all rejoice at the baptism, christening of a child, even if we differ in our understanding of exactly what that ancient ceremony might mean. So we are not a gated community. We have no requirements to enter here. We know that something special happens when we gather here, but we feel not the least inclination to argue about what it is that happens or how. We have no gate. Nevertheless, I still occasionally hear someone express gratitude on being let in. I understand this. Even after many years, I still feel that way at times. And sometimes we have a great emotional need to be embraced, to be welcomed into something that we perceive as greater than ourselves. But when I think about us and how cool it is to be one of us, I often think of the metaphor I learned from Pastor Phil Ramstead years ago. I paraphrase. We welcome people into our fellowship in the spirit of one hungry person telling another hungry person that she's found a place where they both can get a good hot meal. As I blundered about the internet, I kept coming across the term intentional community, and so I thought I'd try to apply the term to us by asking, what are our intentions as a community? Let's go back to the neighborhood of make-believe. What I said about the neighborhood of make-believe, I think I can say about us, or at least about what is our intention to be, quoting myself, the neighborhood of make-believe and our little church is a place where strong personalities can find ways to live together and care for each other, where habits of listening and learning promote an underlying attitude of compassion, where children and adults come to understand that no matter what forces are working to destroy community, these forces haven't a chance in a world that engenders compassion, seeks peace and reconciliation, and honors every individual's quest for self-understanding and self-realization. To which I'd add that it is also our intention to recognize our human need for a relationship with God. We, of course, are free to ask what new ways there might be to explore that, and also free to honor the best of the traditions of our culture and our church. I'm getting sentimental as I get older. Nevertheless, I'll be realistic, if only for a moment. Sometimes we think that we have found the beloved community, and in a post-Eden world, that's probably impossible. Still, once, maybe several times in our life, we come really, really close. I think of this church in that way. But stuff happens. Then we have a choice to make. We can move on, perhaps singing occasionally of Camelot and rejoicing that we had some time there before it crumbled, or we can dig in and help with the rebuilding. No one can read the Bible, especially the Old Testament, without learning that rebuilding, renewal, and recovering what was once lost is always possible. I've learned that perfection is not possible in the most beloved individuals of my acquaintance, and certainly not in myself. And so I recognize that perfection is not to be expected in my beloved community. In my beloved community, I can expect to find delights and challenges similar to those found in the most beloved of human families. The sermon scripture for today is from the 6th chapter of the Gospel of John. I know you've all been wondering when I'd get to it. Jesus says some very disturbing, even bizarre things to his followers. So Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood have eternal life, and I will raise them up on the last day." We are still trying to figure that stuff out. Metaphor? Mystery? best way to speak to a people obsessed with blood sacrifice? Lots of people backed away from Jesus and his teaching at this point. And Jesus asked his disciples if they were going to jump ship too. Peter said what some of us perhaps have said. Peter said, "Where would I go? Where would I go?" And so it is here in my beloved community that I find I'm most at home. And so it is that every Sunday morning I put on my ruby slippers, click my heels, and say, "There's no place like home. There's no place like home. There is no place like home." And by, I find myself right here among all of you, most beloved ones. And may it always be so.